Hey all, I'm Eric Christensen, pharmacist, your host of the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast. Today I'm going to cover heparin, and I've got a lot to cover, so I'm going to get right into it. Heparin is, I guess, classified as a blood thinner in general, but also classified as an anticoagulant. So obviously its effects are thinning the blood, and how it does that is through the mechanism of action where it stimulates the action of antithrombin 3. And antithrombin 3 is important because it inactivates thrombin. And further down that cascade, that action ultimately blocks the conversion of fibrinogen to fibrin. And fibrin is a very, very important component in the formation, activation of clots. So that's how it has its anticoagulant activity primarily. It also has some activity as far as factor 10A as well, and a couple other clotting factors. And this degree of how much it inhibits, you know, thrombin versus other clotting factors does vary a little bit, but more so when we're comparing it to enoxaparin, which is Lovenox, which I will also cover as well here coming up in the next few weeks. So bringing it back home with that mechanism of action, obviously you can think about adverse effects, and one of the primary concerns whenever you use any type of blood thinning agent is going to be blood loss and bleeding. So it's going to be an important monitoring parameter and all that sort of stuff. So why would we use a blood thinning medication? Well, obviously we're going to try to prevent blood clots in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, stroke prevention, prophylaxis, DVT, PE treatment or prophylaxis, you may see it used there. It can be used in the setting of acute coronary syndrome as well under certain situations. Heparin flush is also something that's important that you're going to see out used in practice, and that's to maintain catheter patency. And so that's to prevent basically blood clots in an IV line. And what's important about, you know, different indications and why we're going to use this drug, one very, very important thing is dosing. And I have seen some high-risk situations where inappropriate doses have been used for the wrong thing. So, for instance, a very, very low dose is used in preventing that blood clot in an IV line or that catheter line. So that's very, very important to think about. It's important to recognize, and it's important to remember that heparin is a very, very high-risk medication. And if something doesn't feel, you know, if you're a nurse maybe administering this medication or pharmacist, you know, helping with the dosing and that sort of thing, if something doesn't feel right or you're uncomfortable with it, definitely you've got to ask questions, because errors with heparin certainly have been reported and have happened. And again, it's a very high risk thing that can happen because of the bleed potential as well as the potential for blood clots and things like that in the situation of undertreatment or underdosing. So very, very important to remember. Now, heparin, it is not an oral medication. It's given IV or sub-Q. IM is actually not recommended due to pain and hematoma risk. Dosage adjustments, normally we think about primarily kidney, but also maybe liver. Heparin uniquely doesn't have any dose adjustments with those situations, so that's a very advantageous thing. We don't need to worry about that quite as much. Now, there is some, you know, a little bit of caution, warning, as patients get older in our elderly patient population, you know, they may be a little bit more sensitive to the blood thinning effect of heparin. So, caution is advised, I guess, maybe a little closer monitoring on bleed risk, things of that nature, with our elderly patient population. Let's get into adverse drug reactions, because that's so important. And there's a classically tested drug interaction that you're going to see. So first, I kind of talked about bleeding already. Talk about that in drug interactions, throw out some meds as well with that. So you got to remember that, that anytime you use any sort of blood thinning medication, it's going to increase the risk of bleed. The adverse effect I want to take a good chunk of time here to talk about is heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. So this is kind of a rare, I think, if I recall right, estimates are 1% to 2%. So it's a pretty low risk as far as heparin-induced thrombocytopenia goes. But heparin-induced thrombocytopenia type 2 is a very, very high risk situation. So talking about type 2 heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, this is actually the situation where it's an immune system type reaction that forms these complexes with a factor called PF4 and antibodies. And these complexes can actually kind of coagulate or increase the risk of blocking off blood supply and forming blood clots. And this can increase the risk of thrombosis, which is kind of counterintuitive to actually using the drug, where the drug is actually blood thinning the way it works and mechanistically. But if you get this immune reaction, we can actually increase the risk of thrombosis and clot formation there. So very, very unique reaction, like I said, but can be very, very serious and life-threatening in some cases as well there. Now, the timing of this reaction is important, because there is a heparin-induced thrombocytopenia type 1, and that's a drop in platelets, more so in an acute type situation, within a day or two maybe of starting that heparin. And typically that's not going to be clinically a big deal. But if you see kind of a little bit more delayed onset of that thrombocytopenia, heparin-induced thrombocytopenia type 2, that's the serious one, that's going to take typically multiple days to develop. Maybe in that, 5 to, 10 to 15 day range is when heparin-induced thrombocytopenia type 2 is going to develop. So very, very important on that timing of platelet drop and monitoring and assessing for that in trying to recognize heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. Now, I did want to add with that delayed onset heparin-induced thrombocytopenia type 2, that's typically with an initial dosing of that heparin and not with a redosing. With redosing, so somebody who's had heparin-induced thrombocytopenia before and now you give them heparin again for some odd reason that happens or by mistake or something, that reaction could happen much more quickly, than that, 4 or 5 plus day period. It could happen within a couple days if it's somebody who has those antibodies already developed. So again, a very, very rare situation that would ever happen and likely be an error or something. But that is an important thing to note. So a couple other unique adverse drug reactions. I would say they aren't very common at all, but something to think about and something I've maybe seen come up on pharmacology and board certification exams is the fact that heparin is associated with elevating potassium levels. So that's something to think about. Obviously, there are certain patient populations that may be at higher risk already. So I think of chronic kidney disease as a classic example of a patient that may be at risk for hyperkalemia already. And, maybe that heparin bumps them up a little bit further, maybe more so closer to a danger zone with that level. So again, not incredibly common, but it is something that is associated with heparin. And the mechanism behind that is It actually suppresses or blocks aldosterone production. So if you remember aldosterone antagonists, they raise potassium levels. Heparin kind of has that similar, or at least works on a similar pathway there. Another unique adverse effect is heparin can increase the risk of osteoporosis. Now, this is typically going to be with long-term use, so months of use, which, you know, nowadays heparin isn't typically used long-term. So that's, again, very, very rare adverse effect, but kind of a unique one to heparin if it is used long-term there. The bleed risk I kind of talked about already, obviously probably the most common adverse effect. I did want to mention that there is an antidote to the use of heparin, and that certainly has come up on test questions before throughout my pharmacy career, and that drug is protamine that can be used to kind of counteract the effects of heparin. I did want to mention medication errors. Again, heparin comes in multiple strengths, and I do remember a situation where I believe it was a nurse was trying to use heparin flush, which is a much, much lower dose, obviously, and use it as a sub-Q dose for a patient for, I think it was DVT prophylaxis, if I recall right. But you've got to remember that heparin is a high-risk medication. There are numerous concentration strengths available. And if you aren't comfortable with the math and what we're doing and calculating a dose, you've definitely got to double check and ask somebody else to help you out with that calculation. Monitoring is going to be important. So platelets, I certainly mentioned with heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. If you've got any sort of blood loss, certainly we're thinking about, you know, CBC, and contained within that is, you know, hemoglobin and hematocrit. Bleeding, so just watching, you know, the patient, observing the patient, signs of bleeding and bruising are pretty obvious with this medication. APTT or anti-factor 10A, you may see these utilized or probably will with the use of heparin. I'm not going to get, you know, into the weeds as far as which ones go, which ones are typically used in different situations, because that's a whole podcast in itself. But, you know, cost of the test, variability of the test, you know, what we're doing, what we're treating, all sorts of different factors, what diagnosis conditions the patient has. If they've got heparin resistance, you may see, you know, different testing utilized. So it's a little bit complex, and I may actually consider doing a blog post on this at meded101.com up in the future as well, of, you know, why one test might be used versus the other. But just know that those tests may be utilized in the monitoring of heparin. Let's take a quick break from our sponsor, MedEd101.com. If you're in the market for resources for pharmacist board certification like BCPS, BCACP, BCGP, NAPLEX as well, we've got great resources with our NAPLEX content specifically. You can check out our website, rxgrad.com. We've actually got a free 10-day giveaway where if you subscribe to our email list, we've got 10 days of content coming out, free quizzes, tables, things of that nature to help you prepare for that NAPLEX exam. So really neat resources. So links to all that, meded101.com/store. Finishing up on drug interactions here. So that bleed risk, I mean, that's the most obvious drug interaction. So specifically, maybe more so in our geriatric patients, they've got, you know, multiple chronic conditions, problems. You know, I think about any other anticoagulants. Typically, we're not going to be using those together. The exception, you know, might be conversion or something like that. But your, you know, your warfarins, your apixabans, your rivaroxabans, some of those anticoagulants, excuse me, aspirin, Plavix, a couple of common agents, antiplatelet agents used that could increase that bleed risk. NSAIDs, another kind of classic example that could increase that bleed risk as well. And I did also mention, as far as drug interactions go, that hyperkalemia risk. So I do think about a patient that may be at higher risk. I mentioned chronic kidney disease, but also as far as drug interactions go, you think about some of the other agents that may raise potassium levels. That's certainly something to consider. So your ACEs, your ARBs, your aldosterone antagonists, maybe a trimethoprim, and then obviously any patient on a potassium supplement already and or is maybe borderline elevated on the higher side of potassium, heparin certainly could exacerbate that risk. That's going to wrap up the podcast for today. If you love the show, leave a rating review on iTunes. It's greatly greatly appreciated. We've got the giveaway at reallifepharmacology.com. It's a top 200 study guide. It's a 31-page PDF. So a big PDF where I highlight really, really highly testable pearls and nuggets as far as education goes and things that come up on pharmacology and board exams throughout your career. So go snag that for free. That'll also get you set up to get emails when we've got a new podcast available. So thanks so much for listening. You can find me, your host, Eric Christensen, on LinkedIn. Feel free to connect with me there. And I will let you go. Hope you have a great rest of your day.